more about politics. And probably the thing that's attracting people's attention, or attracted attention for a while now, and it's attracting even more attention now, is the political situation in the United Kingdom. It started off, I suppose, as sort of a phenomenon that was personified by Jeremy Corbyn's success in the recent election. I'm speaking now to John Passant, who's a socialist blogger who's observing things like this. And I'd first like to start off by what has been put forward by a reporter from the Sydney Morning Herald, who said that the Corbyn phenomenon was something that Anthony Albanese from the ALP could take up. And you came back against that, John, pretty firmly. Could you tell us why?
Yes, I can tell you why. I think that it's a mistake to imagine Anthony Albanese as the Australian equivalent of Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn has been in Parliament since 1983 and has been a consistent opponent of war and austerity, including wars and austerity that his own government, the Blair government and the Brown government, were implementing or carrying out. On the other hand, when you look at people like Anthony Albanese, they've been at the centre of the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd governments, and I haven't noticed Anthony at any stage doing a Corbyn and sitting on the backbench criticising the Labor government. And I think there are structural reasons within UK society and Australian society why that's the case, but also that I think the progress of what I would call the Blairite transformation of a Labor Party in Australia has gone much further than has occurred in the UK. And so Corbyn has been allowed to survive and won the election for leadership based on the support of the membership, whereas the voting rules in Australia wouldn't allow Anthony Albanese to become, sorry, wouldn't allow a Jeremy Corbyn equivalent to become leader of the Labor Party. At best, it would be an Anthony Albanese type person. And as I've just explained, he really isn't a Jeremy Corbyn. He's a sort of left-wing Blairite, as far as I can determine.
Yeah, there was an interesting movement that ended up sort of shoving Corbyn into the leadership. Could you, and that was based around a sort of member and supporter-based organisation called Momentum. Could you elaborate on that group?
Well, Momentum came out of partly out of the change to the electoral rules for electing the leadership of the Labor Party in the UK. And essentially it's a membership and supporters vote. And Momentum was a group that coalesced around voting for Jeremy Corbyn. Now, I have to go back a step before this, because Jeremy Corbyn's name on the list of MPs to be considered for the leadership only made it at the last minute before nominations closed in the British Labor Party, because a number of MPs who did not support him and his views of the world decided that they needed an alternative voice amongst the other three or four who were the candidates. And so they signed up to allow him to be, or for him to become, a leadership contender, and he needed 20 MPs to sign a vote, to sign a declaration that they supported his candidature. And so it was only that he got that 20 in the last day or so before the leadership ballot nominations closed that he could become a member and a candidate. A lot of those MPs who actually voted for him did it out of not a sense of support for him, but a sense of, well, we need a wider group standing for leadership, and Corbyn has no chance. However, Momentum and a range of other groups came out and said, well, Jeremy Corbyn is the person who actually represents our politics. He's not a Blairite. He's not a vague lefty. He's a real lefty, and he supports our politics. And he supports policies about redistribution, for example, that will see wealth that workers create returned to workers, that will see the defence of the national health system and so forth. So they began to run a campaign for Jeremy Corbyn. Now, the electoral rules enable people to join the Labor Party. The membership rules. I forget what the figure is. I have £25 in my mind, but there's also a £3 figure in there, which I think is for supporters. And anybody who joins, who is approved for joining, pays this amount of money and then can vote in the election. And Momentum was one of the groups that campaigned to get people to join as members or as supporters and to be able to vote for Jeremy Corbyn. And the end result of their campaign was that something like 59% of those who voted in favour of Jeremy Corbyn. And, of course, that set in place further momentum for people now to be reinvigorated or to be invigorated by politics and to join the Labor Party after Corbyn became the leader. And when the second challenge occurred, when the Blairites moved a vote of no confidence in him and won on a vote of no confidence by about 180 members of the parliamentary party to 40. So there was a re-election, and again he won it, but even more convincingly the second time around, because he'd given hope and imagination and vision to a range of both members and reinvigorated them and brought in a whole range of new members who wanted to see a new society or a changed society in which there was rule for the many, not the few, as Corbyn said in his election campaign.
I noticed really there wasn't much in terms of a way of political criticism in the early days and even now, like when Momentum was setting up and when the membership was rising and everything, you know, people were saying, oh no, all those extra members are all these radical Trotskyites who've been sort of sleeping, and now 30,000 of them have flowed into the Labor Party. Now, I think that's a bit of a thing, saying that a group of 30,000 people are saying, let's sit around until Jeremy Corbyn makes a run for leadership. So it really did sound weird, but the thing that really impressed me was the young people who got involved.
Oh, yes, I think that's a key to what happened both with Corbyn and also you see it in the US with Sanders. And this idea that Corbyn was only elected because there was a surge of Trotskyists and Trotskyites into the Labour Party is nonsense. If there were 30,000 Trotskyists in Britain, then they would have had their own organisation or various factions in their own organisations fighting amongst themselves. It's just nonsense. I mean, it's a classic case of, oh, I couldn't see anything like this happening. Oh, now let's find a reason why it did happen and come up with the most absurd decision or the absurd reasoning for it to happen, rather than face the reality that Jeremy Corbyn represents the politics that are closer to ordinary people's and ordinary voters' interests than you could ever imagine, you Blairites. Or alternatively, if you look at the media coverage, of course Jeremy Corbyn was unelectable, would never win an election, and of course that's one of the reasons why Theresa May, the Prime Minister in the UK, called an early election 3 years early to win a bigger majority on the back of her view that he was unelectable. But he showed both the media and the political class that far from being unelectable, I think he'll be the next Prime Minister of the UK, and that will be in, I don't think, a very long time. I don't see this Tory government surviving for very long. I don't see Theresa May surviving especially after the Grenfell Tower disaster and the political anger that has been stirred up by the reaction of the Tories to that and also the neoliberal policies that they've been implementing over the last 5 years that have contributed to that disaster.
So let's have a look at the knife-edge situation that Theresa May finds herself in. She doesn't have an overall majority in Parliament, and the most likely option at the moment for her is making a coalition with the Democratic Unionist Party from Northern Ireland, a Protestant group who are anti-gay, anti-abortion. And Sinn Féin, the nationalist group there, have saying, well, she can't go into that arrangement. It'll threaten the whole Good Friday Agreement, that is the peace agreement, in Northern Ireland. How do you feel about that? And how do you feel about where Theresa May can turn next?
Well, that's interesting. I was just reading something earlier on today, a report from a British newspaper showing that the deal with the Democratic Unionist Party is not yet set in stone, that she's having trouble getting agreement to it, not only even if she does agree to it, because of their homophobia. The Scottish Conservatives are very concerned because, well, for a start, they're led by a lesbian Tory. And so the deal itself is not sewn up. But as you say, Sinn Féin have said that the peace agreement is threatened by any deal with the Democratic Unionist Party. Not only Sinn Féin, also the Prime Minister of Ireland has said the same thing. Not only the peace agreement is threatened, also the question of Brexit and the nature of Brexit. Now, there's been discussion about what's called a hard Brexit and a soft Brexit. And the hard Brexit is you just move away completely from the European Union, don't allow any cross-border immigration and so forth. But of course, Northern Ireland is attached to, on the northern part of, the Irish island, and so the island of Ireland. Mm. Anyway, you understand what I mean. And the DUP wants continued open borders between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland, which threatens hard Brexit, which is what the Tories want, or elements of the Tories want. So you not only have the question of will the peace agreement survive, you have how can the Tories unify themselves around a deal with the Democratic Unionist Party. So it makes for interesting times. And the fact that the deal has not yet been signed off, that they're now prevaricating about when the Queen's speech will be, and that can only be done when the Democratic Unionist Party and the Tories agree to a coalition. The fact that they're now talking about a two-year gap between the Queen's speeches, so that there might not be one this time around, the fact that she only has 317 Conservative seats, and she needs the other 10 from the Democratic Unionist Party, means that there's a state of uncertainty about this government, and I don't think it will exist, and if it does exist, that it will survive longer than a few months, and that means that there will be a new election. And the polls show that after the election, and then since the Grenfell Tower disaster, the fire in Grenfell Tower, the support for the Labor Party has gone up even further, and that they're now almost in the position that the Tories were in prior to the election on 8 June, and that their percentage of the vote's gone up about 5%. The Tories have now gone down 5% since the election. So that you might have in a few months' time Jeremy Corbyn as the Prime Minister. And indeed there's a protest on the 1st of July that's been called by the left on various left groups in the UK, but supported by the Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, to get Theresa May out. And that protest, John McDonnell, for example, from the Shadow Finance Minister or Treasurer, Chancellor of the Exchequer, he says that he wants 1 million people on the streets to drive Theresa May out of Parliament. Now, that has the capacity, especially in light of the anger around the Grenfell Tower disaster, to actually see millions on the streets, or hundreds of thousands on the streets saying that they want the Tories out. So we have an unstable government. You have a fairly stable opposition in the sense that Jeremy Corbyn's position is entrenched, and the policies that that he put forward in the manifesto, the renationalisation, the saving of the further spending on the national health system and private education, public education. All of these are very, very popular, and so I think any push from the mass of the public and the unions could see the government gone in a short time, even if it's not defeated on the floor of the House. I don't see how it can survive in these uncertain times. And indeed, I think Jeremy Corbyn might be a sensible solution for British capitalism, in the sense that he wants to revitalise it and to redistribute wealth to save it rather than to overthrow it. All this stuff about him being a communist and so forth, I think, is nonsense. He's really a Keynesian who wants a bit more spending in favour of the many and not in favour of the few.
Yeah, I mean, that's thing, if you want to stimulate the economy, you give increases to pensions, not tax cuts to wealthy people. They just pay off their credit cards, whereas pensioners go out and spend it for new lounge chairs and new bedding and stuff.
Oh, not only that, I mean, I'm drawing on the Australian experience, but if you start paying pensioners a living pension rather than something that's below the poverty line, and I think in Australia the figures show that we're a country where 37% of pensioners live below the poverty line. If you start paying them enough so that they're above the poverty line, they start living adequately. They start living as they should be able to do. And it's not just about their consumer capacity and their capacity to buy things like better beds and so forth, but also their capacity to buy more food so that they don't have to live on inadequate food, and that they can pay the rent properly, and that they can pay the electricity bills properly. And it's the same sort of argument in the UK, right? One of Jeremy Corbyn's proposals was to increase pension payments, and also for students to abolish fees on universities and to make universities free. And how is he going to pay for all of this? Well, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. You just tax the rich more, and you could do the same here in Australia. But I don't notice any of the major political parties actually campaigning on major reform to the tax system to tax the rich more. But, you know, that's one of the lessons I draw from the Australian experience compared to the UK experience, that maybe the Australian Labor Party is on its last legs as a socially progressive party, and that there will be something that sparks a revival of social democracy in Australia in the short term or the long term that will bypass the Labor Party and see a new organisation arise. Or perhaps there'll be a revitalisation within the Labor Party around left-wing figures like Sally McManus from the ACTU, who's far to the left of people like Anthony Albanese.
Yeah, it's a bit disappointing. I think the whole Labor Party in the Senate voted in favour of native title laws being changed.
Yes, that really shocked me. I think, as much as I can be shocked, it surprised me somewhat. But if you look at what's going on with the Adani mine and then the change to native title laws, the Adani mine was possibly going to be the process of approval for it might have been waylaid or detoured by some recent decisions by the courts in relation to native title, which is a good thing, you know, not only for the environment but also for Aboriginal people themselves. I mean, I think native title itself doesn't go far enough. What we really should be talking about is a treaty and recognition of prior ownership and sovereignty. But the native title laws as they stood before the amendments went through would have prevented a bit of a barrier to Adani in getting final approval for the mine. So Labor Party is exposed on two counts for voting for the changes to the native title laws. Not only did they undermine the capacity of Aboriginal people to have a say in developments on their own land, especially when those Aboriginal people might be divided amongst themselves, but also they've laid down the groundwork for a fast track or further easy approval of the Adani mine, which will further contribute to the destruction of our environment. A coal mine in these circumstances is the last thing Australia needs. And, of course, for the reef and the future of the reef, it will absolutely be a disaster. So on two counts, the Labor Party has once again shown itself not to be a party of progress. It's opposed. It's voted for amendments to native title, and in doing that, enabled or further enabled Adani to become viable in a state-supported sense rather than an economic sense. And so the destruction of the environment continues apace. Just dreadful.
Now, you've got a background in taxation. You used to be an assistant tax commissioner, didn't you?
Yes, I did, in the ATO. Yep.
And recently, a high flyer in that department had charges laid against him.
Yes, he did. Michael Cranston, whom I worked with at one stage, and the charges related to getting access to information about his family. So that was a breach an alleged breach of the ATO standards, and also a breach of various criminal laws. So he didn't know anything, from all the reports that I read, he didn't know anything about the criminal activity of his children. He just was wondering why their companies were being investigated. And it shows, I think, that the processes within the ATO actually held up, because they were able to pick up him and two of his co-workers who were at the same sort of senior level that I was at when I worked there, who've been suspended. And now Michael Cranston has resigned from the ATO after charges were formally laid against him on a few days ago, last week. So, well, I think the wider issue is, how did this scheme that his children were involved in, allegedly involved in, because they haven't yet been convicted, how did this scheme manage to continue for 9 months? And I think there needs to be an understanding about what processes might have been going on in the ATO and whether there were triggers that were being sent early enough for them to intervene to stop a group of people ripping off allegedly $160 million, which is a lot of money in the space of 9 or 12 months. And I think that those questions, part of the questions that need to be answered there are in relation to the current commissioner and the fact that he's got rid of 3,500 staff over the last few years. So about 16 or 18% of the staff have gone. And that process has got rid of a whole range of mid-level experienced people who've been in the office for 20 or 30 years. And so there are technical issues or technical capability issues within the office now. And also, I think, systems issues. I would have thought the question of somebody skimming off money from the ATO, $160 million through Phoenix companies, through fake companies, should have been flagged straight away to the ATO and dealt with immediately rather than letting them get away with $160 million. I guess, too, one of the other issues here is what are the safeguards that the ATO also should have had safeguards in relation to superannuation, the non-payment of superannuation debts, and it seems to have not had systems in place that caught that quickly enough. So I think there are questions around the systems that the ATO has and the oversight of those systems, and also the fact that that the community has lost 3,500 experienced and well-practiced ATO staff, and it's going to have an impact on revenue collections and on picking up things like these scams and non-payment of superannuation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think there will be longer-term problems for the ATO coming out of getting rid of 3,500 of their staff.
Yeah, going back to cutting back staff, and that sort of turns me back to the UK, where the people in the Tory party are hot on deregulation. And apparently Theresa May's, one of her new advisors, used to be a housing minister whose responsibility was to check fire regulations. And now her whole government is embarrassed by the Grenfell Tower situation, which is, tragic. But it's really set off the anger amongst people.
Oh, absolutely. I think if you look at what the Tory government's deregulation program involved, in fact, that housing minister, who is now her chief of staff, he lost his seat at the last election. He sat on a report for 4 years which recommended that there be tighter safety requirements imposed on landlords. And last year, Jeremy Corbyn moved an amendment to a housing bill that the Tories had introduced, which was basically to make it a requirement of letting that the tenancy, the house or the apartment, be fit for human habitation. And the Tories rejected this, and that it also had certain safety requirements imposed. Also last year, the Tories voted this down. A sensible amendment the Tories voted down, including 72 Tories who are landlords. Last year, too, the Tories changed the guidelines for schools to remove a requirement that sprinklers be put in new schools. So in 2017 on, new schools in the UK do not have a requirement to have sprinklers. In 2012, David Cameron, who was then Prime Minister, came out and said clearly, we're going to kill off the safety culture that exists. It's just red tape that imposes unnecessary costs on landlords and others. Well, yeah, you can see the end results of all of this deregulation. There was an inadequate fire escape program in the refurbished Glenfield Tower. There were more flammable cladding used, which saved them something like £5,000, and they did not put sprinklers in, which saved them £200,000. We're talking about a refurbishment that cost £10 million. So these are some small bickies, but it all added up to make a little bit more profit for those who were doing the refurbishing and also for the ultimate cost.
John, so I'm going to
have it was all driven by profit.
Yes.
And those people died as a consequence of the drive for profit.
Yeah, I'm going to have to cut you off there, John, because we've got our lovely Persian friends coming in.
You've got to go on. Okay.
Thanks very much for being on.
That's all right. Well, thanks for thinking of me and interviewing me. I've appreciated that. It's a good interview. Thank you.
Ta.